You're welcome to Taking Stock on News Talk. I'm Vincent Wall, and each week we take a wider view of some of the major shifts in the global economy and those closer to home. You can get in contact with us by emailing takingstock@newstalk.com or on Twitter at takingstocknt. Now, we're going to place special focus today on money, its good and bad sides, its various forms throughout history, and what it may look like in the future. We're joined first by Jacob Goldstein, the co-host of the podcast Planet Money from NPR, and author of Money, the True Story of a Made-Up Thing. Jacob, you're very welcome, and thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me.
This is a great story, literally ranging back to almost the dawn of civilization and coming right up to the centrality of money in our lives today. Why, though, do you call it a made-up thing?
Well, I mean, the simple answer is because it's a thing people made up. The more interesting to me answer is, you know, before I started studying money, thinking about money, I just kind of passively assumed that it kind of existed in the world like a force of nature, you know, like it existed the way, I don't know, water exists. But that is absolutely not true. You know, money is a thing that people made up and that we continue to make up. It's a set of rules, and we can change those rules if we want to.
And a shared fiction is another term you use for it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, money doesn't exist unless people make it up and agree jointly to use it, right? If one person says something is money, it's not going to work as money, right? So the shared part is lots and lots of people, typically today it's a whole country, have to agree that this made-up thing is money in order for it to work.
Now, going right back almost to the dawn of civilization, the first money, other than bartering, I suppose, where people swapped physical goods, the first money really, it had an intrinsic value itself. It was generally a precious metal that was valued as worth so much in terms of food or labor or even slaves.
Yeah, I mean, money was different things in different places at different times. I mean, coins, which are quite familiar to us as money, were pretty early. They were several hundred years BC. Before that, people were recording debts on clay tablets. In fact, the first writing itself that we know of several thousand years ago in Mesopotamia was not, you know, some epic poem or some love story or something. It was accounting. It was people, you know, at temples essentially recording the debts of, you know, sheep and grain and that kind of thing. So that's a kind of proto-money is the first writing. It's a record of debt.
The Chinese had a very developmental influence on money and how it developed, particularly forms of money that had no intrinsic value, paper.
Yeah, so, well, the Chinese first invented paper, which is a key step if you want paper money. And then around the year 1000 AD, this big breakthrough really happened in Sichuan province in China, where they used iron coins for money. And iron coins, you know, each coin wasn't worth very much. So you needed like a pound and a half of iron coins to buy a pound of salt. So it was terrible, you know, inconvenient money. And some merchant in the capital of Sichuan has this idea, and he says to people, look, leave your iron coins with me, and I will give you a receipt, you know, like a coat check ticket, basically, for your coins. And those receipts, those coat check tickets themselves, start to function as money. And the government sees that it's working, and the government gets involved and starts printing paper money, and it spreads all over China. And then a few hundred years later, China's still using money, and the Mongols conquer China, and Kublai Khan is the great Khan, and he loves paper money. And then that moment you referred to, this moment that, you know, defines the modern world but was wild back in the day, Kublai Khan says, you know what? From this moment forth, the paper money is just going to be paper. You can't trade it in for metal coins anymore. And it basically worked for quite a while.
Did it work, given Kublai Khan's terrible power and literally the power to put you to death in an instant? Did that shared trust in a fictional entity, was that given extra authority by the fact that he forced you to have faith in this particular form of money?
Yeah. Use this money or I'll kill you is a really like powerful form of monetary policy, right? So yes, certainly the fact that he was this authoritarian ruler must have been helpful. But, you know, it's also the case that by this point, people in China had been using paper money for hundreds of years, right? Approximately as long as we've been using paper money in the West now. So it was not some crazy new thing. And so, you know, paper money itself was well established. I don't think a ruler, you know, could come fresh and force people to use a new kind of money and necessarily have it work. So I think it took both in that instance.
One of the interesting things about the book is that there aren't always necessarily linear developments. So subsequently, a couple of hundred years later, at the beginning of the Ming Dynasty, things went back.
Yeah, it's this really extraordinary moment. So China has had paper money for hundreds of years, and they've actually had this economic really revolution that went on with it. And they had new technologies and they had flourishing cities and even this restaurant scenes and just this really booming market-based money-driven economy that would be, you know, somewhat familiar to us. And then, as you say, this new dynasty, the Ming, they force out the Mongols, take control of China, and they don't like any of this. They don't like the market economy. They don't like paper money. Their ideal is the self-sufficient agricultural village. And they wind up getting rid of paper money altogether. And so paper money is this incredible, you know, technological breakthrough. It works. It's great. It's good for China's economy. And then they get rid of it. And it actually disappears from the world for hundreds of years until it reappears in Europe.
And they didn't get rid of just its commercial value as paper money, but also the social value that had accumulated with the use of paper, because people could actually spend their time doing other things rather than just producing the food or the metal that they exchanged as money before.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, paper money makes trade easier, right? This was an era, obviously, when there's no mechanized transport. And so having to move, you know, heavy metal coins across great distances was quite costly. So paper money was a technological breakthrough, and it led to more trade. And what trade allows people to do is specialize, right? It make a thing that where you live is particularly well suited to, for example. So there were people who had fish hatcheries, right? And then they would transport the fish to other places to raise the fish. There were people who had orchards full of mulberry trees, and the silkworms would eat the leaves, and they would make silk, and then they would turn the bark into paper. And so it was this really specialized economy with a relatively high amount of division of labor. And that is how you get economic growth. That is how you get the pie getting bigger. That is how you get people getting richer. And when the Ming Dynasty came in, they reversed that. Like, people in China actually got poorer than their ancestors had been hundreds of years earlier. So the sort of chilling lesson of that is, you know, we're used to economic growth. You know, often it benefits everyone. Sometimes it just benefits people at the top. But at least we're used to growth. And that is not a given in the history of the world. Most of the history of the world is stasis. And sometimes you even get poorer over hundreds of years.
Yeah, so no necessarily linear progression, and certainly no regional progression, because as you say, when the use of paper money died out due to the ruler's view of society in the Ming Dynasty, it didn't occur anywhere else in the world for some time. And we saw that metal still, the intrinsic value of metal still right up to almost modern Europe was necessary for money. Tell us about what the Swedes carried around in the 17th century.
Yeah, so the Swedes, so this was the area where, as you say, precious metals were money. Sweden happened to have abundant copper resources. So that was nice for them. But unfortunately, you know, copper is not that valuable relative to gold or silver. So they had these, I mean, you could call them coins. Sometimes people call them plate money. Basically, these giant pieces of copper that served as money. And the largest one, which 10 dalers, was weighed like 30 pounds and was like the size of a little desktop. People would carry it strapped to their back, which obviously sounds terrible, right? And so perhaps it's no surprise that the first place we see paper money in Europe is Sweden, and kind of a replay of what had happened in Sichuan in China. The Swedes actually set up a bank, that's the predecessor of their national bank today, where people can essentially store their copper plates and get paper in exchange. And again, this is great, right? This is a technological breakthrough.
So that happened in Sweden because of the convenience of paper rather than carrying a lump on your back. And also, I suppose it was safer. Developments elsewhere in Europe around the same time were beginning to lead to paper as well. The receipts of goldsmiths in London, for instance.
Yeah, so that's an interesting one that has a twist. So the London goldsmith story is somewhat similar. You know, this is the 16th century, which was this very violent time in England. And so people were storing their gold with goldsmiths in London for safekeeping and getting receipts. And those receipts turned into paper money. So that part of the story is familiar. There's an interesting development in London that we don't see in those other stories we've talked about, which is the London goldsmiths start making loans to people. So they're not just storing gold anymore, but they're making loans. And the way they make loans is they write you essentially a receipt, a check, you know, a claim check for gold that they don't have. So you walk in and instead of depositing your gold with them, you just say, I want a loan. And they write you a claim check that says, you know, this ticket is good for whatever amount of money worth of gold. And then you walk out with that claim check. And so this is good in that it makes it easier to get loans and there's more paper money sort of passing hand to hand in London, which makes it easier to transact, to do business. It's bad because now there are more claims on gold in that goldsmith shop than there is gold, right? So if everybody who has a claim check ticket, a piece of paper money, goes to the goldsmith shop at the same time and says, I want my gold back, the goldsmith is not going to have the gold. And this is fractional reserve banking, right? This is essentially the way banks work today. And if everybody goes to the bank and demands their money back, the bank is still not going to have it. So there is this really interesting tension at the heart of the most basic kind of banking, which is it's useful, makes it easier for people to get loans. It makes it easier for the economy to grow when it needs to grow. But there is this fundamental fragility that is absolutely baked in.
Yeah, the banks as a store of the shared fiction, so to speak. Our guest here on News Talk is Jacob Goldstein, the co-host of the podcast Planet Money and author of Money, the True Story of a Made-Up Thing. Coming right up to the early 19th century, Jacob, I was fascinated by just the sheer range and variety of the types of money that prevailed in the, I suppose, what was then the young United States.
Oh, yeah, that's such an extraordinary moment in the history of money. And I'll say, you know, I studied U.S. history. I grew up in the States and I never knew this story until I started learning about money. So in the first half of the 1800s, before the Civil War, you know, 1840s, 50s, essentially every bank in the United States printed its own kind of paper money. So there were literally thousands of different kinds of paper money circulating in the country, which is wild, right? I mean, you know, at the time, people still thought of paper money very much as a claim on gold, right? So maybe not quite as wild as it would be to us. But it was the case that, you know, for example, if you were a merchant, you would have to subscribe to these kinds of periodicals called banknote reporters that would tell you what every bank's money looked like, because, of course, there was a ton of counterfeiting in this world, and also would tell you whether you should accept the bank's notes, the bank's paper money, at face value, or whether you should apply some discount to it. Because remember, the paper is only as good as the bank's ability to exchange it for gold or silver, right? So if the bank is either far away from where you are, or if the bank is maybe going to go out of business, you should apply a discount to the value of the note, right? So often, you know, somebody would walk in with a dollar, the merchant goes and checks their little banknote reporter, finds that it's valid and says, yeah, I'll accept it, but I'm only going to give you 90 cents of value, say, in exchange for that paper dollar because the bank is far away or because maybe it's a little shaky and I'm not sure I'm going to get my silver out.
That whole concept of the discounting of value, that people are still prepared to put some value on what they see as something that's not as trustworthy or as valuable as a separate piece of money. I mean, very obvious in times of war, I'm conscious of the Confederate dollar during the U.S. Civil War becoming almost worthless in time.
Yes. And the same happened to the Continentals, to the, you know, American rebels in the Revolutionary War. That, you know, in the sort of pre-modern era, that was really the only time that governments would resort to money printing was during times of war. And, you know, we see it today outside of sort of currency money, right? If you think of like, well, I guess inflation is a kind of discounting money in a different way, but also like government bonds, right? Short-term government bonds are sort of money adjacent, and you'll see the value of bonds change as people worry about the government.
We mentioned there the fact that right up to the modern era, even though people were prepared to take pieces of paper as a symbol of some value and share it, that piece of paper in their heads had to be backed up by a similar value in gold. And it was Franklin D. Roosevelt who ultimately broke that connection.
Yes, yes. In the United States, I should say, in fairness, because I'm talking to you, that the Bank of England had gone off the gold standard a couple years earlier in 1931. Roosevelt did it in 33. But this moment, you know, the early 30s in general, when the Depression was forcing one country after another off the gold standard, was this really profound historical turning point in the history of money, because it is the case that up until then, you know, money had been backed by metal. The gold standard, the sort of high gold standard, existed for about 100 years or so. But in various ways, the notion that just paper could be money was quite novel. And people at the time resisted it. You know, they sort of figured out later that the gold standard itself was a fundamental driver of the Great Depression, because the problem was prices were falling and wages were falling. So debts were becoming more and more burdensome. And the essential way to fight that is to essentially print more money, make it easier for people to borrow money, lower interest rates. But the gold standard largely prevented countries from doing that. And so Roosevelt's own advisors even were saying, whatever you do, don't go off the gold standard, basically. But Roosevelt, I think, saw more clearly that, you know, money was a choice, the gold standard was a choice, and he liked experimenting. And so not long after he was elected, he took the United States off the gold standard, and it was a good move. Things started to get better.
Coming right up to date, and I was fascinated by the fact that you started this journey, this exploration of what money is and our attitudes to it, with a discussion with your aunt around the time of the great financial crash of 2008, when so much money disappeared. But there are many complex reasons as to what happened at that time. But one of the key reasons, you believe, is what seemed like a very complex financial instrument ultimately was behaving like cash.
Yeah, I mean, it seems complex in some ways and simple in others, right? So it's the money market mutual fund, which is kind of a mouthful of a name, but a pretty straightforward kind of account that, you know, if you have money in a brokerage account, say, and they say some of it is in cash, quite often it's not, you know, it's never paper bills, right? It's typically not even a bank account, at least not in the States. What it quite often is something called a money market mutual fund. And a money market mutual fund is something that two guys invented in the early 70s. And the idea was to make it look like a checking account, you know, a simple bank account, basically, where you put a dollar in and you can take a dollar out whenever you want and you can write some checks on it, but that paid higher interest. In the United States at the time, regulations actually from the Depression limited the amount of interest people could get on their bank accounts. So they would take people's money and then they would invest it in initially very safe things like government bonds or big bank savings accounts that paid high interest rates because they were big. And the notion was, in a money market mutual fund, you, the customer, your dollar is always worth a dollar. So it doesn't feel like an investment that might gain or lose interest, although technically it was. And what happened was, over time, these accounts brought in more and more money. And so the people running the funds needed to find places to put the money, right? They needed to lend it out and get interest. And that lending ended up driving a tremendous amount of the bubble of the early aughts, right? The housing bubble of the early aughts, that is the famous part of the crisis with the subprime mortgages and everybody getting a loan. The source of a tremendous amount of that money was money market mutual funds that were lending to the, you know, shadow banks and the mortgage lenders that were making these loans. And what happened in the heat of the financial crisis in the fall of 2008, when Lehman Brothers went bankrupt, was the original money market mutual fund, the one that these two guys had invented, 40 years earlier, had been lending money to Lehman Brothers. And Lehman Brothers is now bankrupt, so the mutual fund's not going to get paid back. And so suddenly there's essentially a bank run on this thing that's not really a bank, on a money market mutual fund, and on all the other money market mutual funds. And that is an underappreciated part of the panic. That causes a collapse, really, in this whole sort of banking system, a parallel banking system that had sprung up. And the government ends up guaranteeing the money market mutual funds to stem the crisis, basically.
Yeah, we all know what happens when the awful truth dawns about the shared fiction. In some cases, long lines accumulate outside bank doors. We now know we're using plastic as money more and more, Jacob. But where do you see the future of money going, particularly with the advent now of cryptocurrencies, the likes of Bitcoin, which are effectively generated by shadowy characters using computer power?
Well, you know, there are a few interesting things about Bitcoin. One thing that's interesting to me at this point is Bitcoin has been around for a while now, right? It's 12 years since Bitcoin was introduced, which is a long time, certainly in terms of technology, I guess not long in the history of money. And so we see these two sort of contradictory things happen with Bitcoin. One is it's worth a lot of money, right? Like people will exchange a lot of dollars or pounds in exchange for one Bitcoin, thousands and thousands, right? On the other hand, people aren't really using it to do much. You know, I mean, some hackers, you know, use it to when they want a ransom. People use a Bitcoin to move money out of countries that have currency controls or capital controls that don't let you take your money out. But it's not really money in the sense of a thing people buy stuff with, right? So I don't quite know what to make of that. I mean, I will say in the sort of long run, you know, the government or governments are so associated with money now. Governments control money, right? And part of the dream of Bitcoin is a money that is not controlled by a government. And it seems hard to imagine that shift happening. If it does happen, it would be like profound and huge, but I don't really know how you get there from here.
I suppose as long as humans are social animals, money will continue to change in shape and nature. But we'll leave that fascinating story there. That's Jacob Goldstein, the co-host of the podcast Planet Money from NPR and author of Money, the True Story of a Made-Up Thing. Jacob, thanks indeed for joining us.
Oh, it was great to talk with you. Thanks for having me.
We'll hear next from Tom Burgess, investigations correspondent with the Financial Times and author of Kleptopia, How Dirty Money is Conquering the World. Tom, you're very welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Absolute pleasure, Vincent. Thanks for having me.
Now, before we go any further, Tom, can you define what kleptopia is and I suppose what the kleptocracies are, the countries where it generally takes place?
Yes. Well, what I mean is places where corruption rules. So we tend to think of corruption as being an aberration, as being something when government goes wrong, when something comes unstuck in the ruling class. But what happens when corruption is actually the main force in a place, when corruption is how power is wielded? And 5 years ago, I met a disgruntled Swiss banker in a bar in London and followed the trail he set me off all around the world, Congo, Kazakhstan, back to London, off to the US. And you start to see more and more that corruption is becoming the dominant force, the dominant way power is wielded in more and more of the world. And it's starting to creep into and destabilize the few remaining democracies.
Yeah, that's the key point of the book, I suppose. I mean, we have known about corrupt states for a long time, and they tend to be in the usual parts of the world, unfortunately, particularly Africa, where I know you've lived yourself. But the way of sustaining these kleptocracies and the elites who run them is that they need to find homes and legitimize the money they've stolen in the West. And the purpose of the book is to show how easy that is to do.
Yeah. I mean, it's an absolutely stomach-turning story. And what I've tried to do is tell some personal stories so you can see the sort of human impact of the spread of corruption, the terrible human suffering that it causes. But the thing to remember, and you're right to make this point, the thing to remember is that corruption isn't something that's based on race or culture. Corruption doesn't feed on left-wing politics or right-wing politics. Corruption is blind. It takes hold wherever there's greed and wherever institutions are weakened. And the idea that the West are somehow immune to this is a huge and dangerous mistake. And what's happened since really the end of the Cold War is that kleptocrats who used to operate within their nation states, they've globalized like Starbucks or anything else. And, you know, in whether it be through using the tax haven advantages of Ireland or the secrecy advantages
God forbid,
of the
Tom,
city
God
of London.
Forbid.
God forbid, or the secrecy advantages of the City of London or New York real estate with Donald Trump's name on it. There are 1,000 pipelines to take dirty money from the places where it is made lawlessly into the places where these kleptocrats, these oligarchs, these corrupt politicians can enjoy the freedom of the West. And with that money comes violence and danger and the corruption of democratic systems, because to protect themselves, these kleptocrats need to buy influence. And that means subverting democracies.
We might come to some of those personal stories in just a little bit later, but your point being as well that there are swathes of professionals, whether they be bankers, accountants or lawyers, in major financial centres such as New York, such as London, who are more than happy to take this money and launder it.
Precisely. I mean, why do you think it's practically impossible to buy a house in London? Because anonymous money flowing in, often from kleptocracies, the former Soviet Union, parts of Africa and so on, is secretly buying up real estate. Money, dirty money is all around us if we just stop and look. Private school fees, the art market, as I say, real estate, and most troublingly, in lobbying of politicians.
You say, actually, it certainly comes out of the book to me, that London is an easier place, a more convenient place to launder money than the United States, where at least the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act is a pretty potent weapon if it's used to try and track this money and bring people to book.
Yeah, I think one of the things that really I found difficult reporting the book, and I was digging deeper and deeper and deeper into this terrifying world, was trying to understand, why are we so receptive to dirty money? Why, especially in the city of London, why is the UK so keen to soak up this money? And eventually it struck me that, you know, we get furious about tax evasion when multinationals fleece us of the taxes that are due, but we turn a blind eye to money laundering, to money coming in. And I think, sadly, it's pretty simple. We're talking about declining powers that are running out of cash. And the British establishment certainly seems to have decided, explicitly or not, you know what, we don't care the flavor or the smell of this money. We want anything we can get. And we threw open our doors to corrupt money. And now we're starting to see what it came with in terms of the real dangers of undermining those things that are more precious than money.
And do you think this is being done in full knowingness of where this money is likely to have come from, or just that people aren't too interested in actually checking too hard, and that it's a trend that's likely to continue as post-Brexit the UK needs to develop different types of relationships with other jurisdictions in terms of trading, that those types of influencers bought by dirty money are going to have more power?
Well, I think that's the terrifying prospect. Yeah, just to take those two questions. The first one, do people know what they're dealing with? In some cases, no. In some cases, people are genuinely ignorant of the money that flows in to the UK. I don't think you can say that every estate agent in London knows that they're dealing with dodgy money often. But there was an expression that was used to me when I talked to someone who dealt with the dirty money deals that Donald Trump did before he became president. That's how he sustained his real estate empire, by soaking up dirty money, especially from the former Soviet Union. And this person used the expression about Trump, willful obliviousness. And I think that perfectly captures it. You know, these are, we have a broad idea of where this money is coming from, but we choose to look away so we don't have to answer awkward questions. Now, will the UK, after Brexit, become more open to dirty money? I think there is a really worrying strand among a sort of people who are pushing for a very hard Brexit, who want to make a sort of Singapore on sea, who want the UK to be low tax, low regulation, and to be open to all comers, to be open to money regardless of its origins. And that would be to surrender even further to the corrupt interests that have that are subverting the rule of law in the UK.
Speaking of Donald Trump, and of course it's important to stress that he would deny any such allegations that his property empire has been funded by dirty money, certainly to his knowledge. You don't actually mention him until well into the book, page 250, and then we recognise who he is, but he's an unnamed US developer trying to build a skyscraper in Toronto in Canada. Why have you kept him that low-key so far in? Is it fear of litigation against yourself?
No. Although there have been, I was sent legal letters that in total were twice the length of the book before it was published. So I had
by whom?
By most of the people in it. But and they're very expensive lawyers. But the the reason that we structured the book as I did is hopefully to make it a thrilling yarn, but also because actually Trump was a fairly minor player in this world. You know, we're talking about really serious, immensely wealthy people close to Putin, close to the dictators elsewhere in the former Soviet Union, close to some of the most dangerous people in Africa and so on. And Donald Trump was really a failed businessman who banks would no longer lend to, who started to sustain his fortune and his self-image as a kind of tycoon by pulling in money of dubious origin from the former Soviet Union and elsewhere for many, many years and asking no questions about where it came from. And then through a very unusual set of circumstances and a few twists of history, he's suddenly president. And you can
That's
see...
That's democracy, Tom.
It absolutely is. But look around at his allies and the people he chooses to cultivate. What they have in common is that they are looting the states they control. Putin, Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia, the Kims in North Korea, and so on. What they're all interested in, where their interests all align, is being able to capture public office and divert our money, public money, to their own private interests.
You point out that Donald Trump pushed back against that legislation, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, for whatever reason. But you also point out that there are other loopholes in the American environment, in the sense that there hasn't been any action to try to prevent the formation of shell companies that could use foreign loot, foreign stolen money, effectively, to buy assets in the United States, and that real estate in particular is a key target for dirty money, particularly in the United States.
Absolutely. What happened was that the New York Mafia, the five families, the Italian Mafia in the US, has been using real estate in Manhattan and elsewhere to launder criminal proceeds for decades. And then gradually, after the end of the Cold War especially, more and more money started to flow in from the former Soviet Union. Now, what you can do in the US is you can park money in real estate pretty much anonymously. After 9/11, there was a thing called the Patriot Act, and it was supposed to make bringing anonymous money into the US more difficult to try to combat terrorist financing. But the real estate industry got an exemption from those controls. So money still flows into the US basically without any checks. And the volume of dirty money that's passing through the real estate industry is almost incalculably large. And the effect of that is that those who rape and pillage their countries can secure those assets, can secure that wealth in the US, which isn't just a case of them being able to have a few nice flats. What that means is they can entrench their power because they can secure their wealth outside their countries, and that makes them less accountable within those countries.
Our guest here on News Talk is Tom Burgess, author of Kleptopia: How Dirty Money is Conquering the World. It's a page-turner, a grim page-turner in its own right, Tom, if I might say so. Just some of the human stories, some of the human oppression and violence that has been exercised on people in various countries around the world. Some daring do stuff, people escaping with diamonds in toothpaste tubes late at night as the law comes upon them. Tell us a couple of key stories. Nigel Wilkins is an unsung hero of your book.
Yeah. So Nigel was an extraordinary man. And without giving everything away, he's the chap I met in a bar 5 years ago. And he said to me, well, I used to work at a Swiss bank, and there was certainly a lot of dirty money passing through that. He used to work in the office of a Swiss bank that was just round the corner from the Bank of England in London. And anyway, gradually, Nigel started to tell me that he'd actually photocopied a lot of the secret documents from that Swiss bank and gave them to me. And I started to follow those threads, and they led to Central Asia. They led indirectly to Congo. And what I started to see was something that Nigel had started to understand, which was that behind dirty money, behind these systems of corruption, what guarantees and underpins them is ultimately violence. So Nigel wasn't treated with personal violence, but he was treated with a kind of professional violence. He was humiliated and shut out of the city marched from his building for daring to violate banking secrecy. But then I went on further, and I made it to places like the Kazakh steppe, and I made it to the town where a few brave striking oil workers had tried to stand up to a corrupt dictator, and what they got in exchange was security forces descending on them and massacring them, and the survivors being tortured to try to doctor the public record. And their stories, I think, are some of the most harrowing in the book. And I hope they start to make us understand how what we think of as far off despots with names we can't pronounce are actually intimately linked to our lives here. To give you one example, after that massacre, the Kazakh dictator, who has been busily guzzling dirty money around the world for decades, he turned for advice on how to handle this massacre, how to portray himself in the West in the aftermath of this massacre. He turned to one of the great communicators of Western politics, Tony Blair, who gave him advice on how to do just that. And if we think that these moments of horror and violence are unconnected to our own lives, I hope the book shows that they're creeping closer and closer.
I assume Tony Blair would argue that he wouldn't have been aware of any direct connection between the Kazakh leader and the events you describe.
Well, Tony Blair says that he was just doing consultancy work for the Kazakhs. I mean, I have the letter he wrote to Nazarbayev, the Kazakh dictator. Blair maintains he hasn't done anything wrong. We don't know how many of his fortune of millions upon millions he made from his Kazakh work, but what he suggested to the Kazakh dictator was to try to, you know, stress your great achievements and essentially play down this massacre. Yeah. It's Nazarbayev didn't pull the trigger in the square on that December day when those dozen or so people were slaughtered, but he presided over a system where the rule of law and civil power are completely absent, and the only powers are corruption and violence. So he is ultimately responsible for what happened.
And we might finish, Tom, with a very current story, and again, just one of many examples throughout the book. And this is the story of two South African mining executives who died in mysterious circumstances in Middle America, executives with the Eurasian Natural Resources Corporation, and the subject of an ongoing FBI inquiry there now.
Absolutely. James Bethel and Gerrit Strydom, two men in their 40s, they were working, as you say, for ENRC, which was a sort of £20 billion multinational mining house listed on the London Stock Exchange, one of the most valuable companies in Britain at one stage, now the subject of a seven-year corruption investigation by the UK's Serious Fraud Office. These two men who died were both potential witnesses in that corruption investigation. Now, I must stress, we don't know what happened to them, but what we do know is that the official explanation that they died of malaria really no longer holds water. My investigation shows, and we've got hold of quite a lot of the records from the case, that the official diagnosis, or if you like, the official cause of death given by local police that they died of malaria is vanishingly unlikely to be true. We also know that the FBI is now investigating, and I think what it shows, although as I say, we don't know what befell them, but what it shows, or what it might prove to show, is that this world where business and violence mix together is no longer confined to places we might think of where this happens, such as the former Soviet Union or Central Africa, but has become global as dirty money has gone global.
We have a lot of on our plate at the moment as global citizens, Tom, but what can we as citizens of Western democracy do to try to address this growing problem by the sounds of it?
Well, I think there are two things. One is pretty straightforward. It's the kind of thing you do, the kind of thing I try to do, and lots of other people try to do, which is just honest journalism and just trying to follow the money, essentially, as Bob Woodward was once told. Just try to keep track of the large flows of money into our countries and our politics. We need to support independent judiciary, good, independent, bloody-minded members of parliament, The other thing I think we need to pay attention to is just the nature of money. Enormous, trillions upon trillions and trillions, enormous sums of money sit in the financial secrecy system that typically connected to the City of London, essentially parked in little islands around the world where you don't know who controls it. Money is just a token for you, me, and anyone else to live a life in a society together, to exchange our goods and services. Its meaning has become broken, and I think we have to reassert our right to know where money is moving and who's controlling it, and to remember that money is a means for real human people to live their life together in society. It's not a means for power to be wielded in secrecy.
On that rallying call, we leave it there. That's Tom Burgess, investigations correspondent with Financial Times and author of Kleptopia, How Dirty Money is Conquering the World. Tom, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure, Vincent. Thanks for having me.
Taking stock on News Talk.
Thanks to Skillnet Ireland, driving business success through innovative training and upskilling.